Go.
All right. Before telling you about more about Howard, I think I have to tell you how different the two boys are. There are 3.5 years difference between the two of them. Both of them were raised in the same house, however, at different times, and I'm sure that we as parents were entirely different in raising each son. The older son is much more conservative. He went away to college. He always returned with a tie, with a sport coat. Howard lived through the rebellious 60s and 70s. We already thought when he was in high school, he was amongst the bright kids that were in special programs at school, and they were always the kids that were rebelling. He ended up going on all the marches, on taking special courses at school where you didn't even get graded. There were times we didn't know where he was. He took off in the summer for 6 weeks. And we hear from other people, I think he left at that time with a pair of blue jeans, a pair of undershorts, and a toothbrush. But that was the norm at that time. Julian's hair was always cut properly, a little on the longer side when that was the style. Howard's was so long that I was delighted when it was finally in a ponytail. At least it wasn't getting in the soup or in the butter. So you see the difference between the two sons. And basically, that's why Howard ended up going into the neighborhood legal service, because he didn't want to go into a big firm. He didn't want to work for a corporation. Somebody was selling a law practice in Homestead. He didn't want to be near the steel mills because the air wasn't good. So he ended up working for the neighborhood legal service, first with abused children and then later on in the family division, and that's where, as I mentioned before, where he met his wife, Denise. Denise made this decision to convert to Judaism right after the Seder. Whether she ever married Howard or not, she came from a broken home, and her mother was a Catholic, and the father didn't practice his religion. I guess he was a Protestant, and she saw she had had a great deal of family upheaval, and she saw the cohesiveness of this Jewish family. She also was very impressed with the Seder service, with the reference to being slaves, to be concerned for human beings, and she decided to take lessons and to convert to Judaism. When we found out about it, or when Howard mentioned it, we had discussed this many times, how we would feel about either one of them bringing in a non-Jewish girlfriend, and we said we would be civil, but we certainly would not be happy with the whole situation. And if you look around this house, I even have relatives to this day saying, how could it happen in your house with your background and all the things, yeah, and your support of Israel and the synagogue? And the minute you walk into this house, you know it's a Jewish house, but we're living in a very open society, and you just can't put your children in a cage. And we certainly aren't the ultra-Orthodox. I mean, my husband and I bend a lot of rules, and we feel for living in the 20th century, there isn't too much you can do. We made a decision to invite Denise to the Seder and then to go along with the marriage. And of course, she had the full conversion before they even got married. She came here one day, it was Mother's Day, with her hair soaking wet because she had gone to the mikveh. And one of my aunts and I was like, why did she have to go to the mikveh? She thought that was very degrading, that a woman should have to go to the mikveh. And my other daughter-in-law went with her, Cookie went with her to the mikveh. They got married also at the Beth Shalom, and it was a lovely Jewish wedding. They did things perhaps a little differently. She was amongst the first. She thought that the young woman and the young man should break the glass together, so I don't know how happy the rabbi was with that. But it was a traditional wedding, just as traditional as the other family. I will say this, with regard to the family, in spite of the fact that the mother and father were separated, they were very cooperative for the marriage and cooperative for the whole ceremony, and both of them walked down the aisle with her, as if, you know, there weren't any hard feelings or differences between them, and there certainly were. They lived in Squirrel Hill for a while. They just recently moved to Mount Lebanon. They have two little girls. One is 4.5, and one was just 3. they had problems, they lost the baby, and then she had trouble conceiving, so they made a decision to try to adopt the child. She was just devastated. And they came to us telling us there was a possibility that they would be able to get a biracial child. And how would we feel about that? And would we be able to love this child as much as the other two granddaughters? And we told them there would be no question about it, that we would love the child the same way. However, we try to present all the future problems that may arise from adopting such a child. And they made the decision to go ahead with the adoption. And I will say that from we were at the house, they got this baby quite suddenly. We were at the house when the third party brought the baby home from the hospital. She was only 3 days old, and if anything, we have great love for this child. She's a beautiful little girl. We were both just here yesterday.
That How was, biracial?
The father was black, and the mother was, and she's, the mother was white. She's dark, not real dark. You know, when they're first born, they're all white, and they look just like other children. When they brought her home, she looked like she would just end up being light all the time. She is not light. However, if she was in Israel, she would fit in because they have all colors there, and there isn't really discrimination against color. She's certainly not as dark as some of the Yemenites. She's not as dark as some of the Ethiopian Jews are very black. And I have friends, even some family members, that are as dark as she is. Her hair is curly, but not as kinky as, you know, a black person. We had some problems with the with her. She had to be converted too, you understand. And our children had gone to Israel when I was installed before they adopted Dina. And they really were concerned that if they ever should decide to make Aliyah or go to Israel, that there shouldn't be any questions about this child. So we tried to get one of the Orthodox rabbis here. I don't know, each one of them had some cockamamie excuse as to why they didn't want to do it, or couldn't, not that they didn't want to do it, why they couldn't do it at that particular time. And I think part of it was because of this, the fact that Denise herself was converted, and was not converted by Orthodox rabbis, but by conservative rabbis, although she went to the mikveh, had the witnesses, has the papers, and they just did not want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So we ended up, once the adoption, and that, you know, took the normal 6 months, we had to wait to make sure that the mother didn't decide she wanted the child back, etc. And we went down to the court. We had a big celebration, dinner, you know, we had the whole family when the adoption became final. And we had the naming in the shul for Dina. And she too went to the mikveh, and they had three conservative rabbis and the normal amount of witnesses, whoever had to be there at the time. And she does have the papers. I don't know how this will hold up, you know, with the rabbinate in Israel, with all the mishigas that they have over there, but I'm not too concerned. She is a Jewish child as far as we are concerned, and she's very much accepted by the family and by her cousins, etc. And they now have a second little girl, and her name is Shana, and naturally after they adopted her, she got pregnant. So they're very close in age. And just as one is dark, the other is as yellow as a dandelion. Her hair is really blonde. They both came in here yesterday with little straw hats and flowers, and one has the black curly hair, and one has the very blonde curly hair, and they're sisters. So those are those two granddaughters. The other son has two daughters. One is Sarah, named after my mother, and she's 12. She's going to be bat mitzvah in October. And she goes to the Beth Shalom, and she has a sister, Rachel, who she also goes to the Beth Shalom, but both girls went to the community day school. And Rachel is still at the community day school, which is now the community day Solomon Schechter school. And that school is a day school, full day school, that meets at they meet at the Hebrew Institute. That's their home. Mm-hmm. At the Hebrew Institute, because the Hebrew Institute does not have a student body like it used to years ago. Kids either go to the temple or their synagogue, or to the day school. I mean, we have the Yeshiva Day School and the Hillel and then the Community Day School. So I think they've gotten a pretty good Jewish education, maybe not as good as I would even hope, but the Community Day School is getting much better, and I can see that the second granddaughter, Rachel, is doing a lot better than Sarah, that's in spite of the fact that they're very good students, but as far as the Hebraic, Judaic background, Rachel now has a better background than Sarah did.
Why, can I ask, why couldn't you send them to the Beth Shalom school? Or why couldn't they?
Well, let me backtrack. If you recall, for a while, the public school system was very poor. And I have to be very open and honest that the community day school was opened up by a group of parents as really an alternative to the public school system that was so poor. It was a group of parents who were not that orthodox, and they did not want to send their children to Hillel Academy or to the Yeshiva. So they started this school. And at the beginning, I mean, just little by little, they had to have some Judaic Hebraic curriculum, but very little at the beginning, very, very little. And there were a great many of them were from the Reformed Temple, as a matter of fact. So it turned out to be a very good school. It's an accredited school today. And little by little, they have a Hebraic Judaic department. Dr. Ron Bronner, who's the head of the Hebrew Institute, works with them. Sippy Gore, Hansi Butler works with them. So it is a very, very fine school. As far as the kids are concerned, I was always against day schools. This is years ago, but I don't feel that way today. I feel that I want these kids, and I tell this to my children too, because it is a very costly proposition. You could send kids, 1 year costs more than the 4 years in college when they went to college. And I tell them, don't you, as long as you can afford it, don't you feel that you want your children to know more than you know, to have this wonderful background? And they've agreed, and every time if I go to the programs or I see what they know, I really shep nachas too, plus the fact that it happens to be a very fine, small school where they get individual attention, and they're not thrown into the rank and file of the city schools. Now, the city schools happen to be improving now. Sarah goes to Spirit, which is a magnet school, and that's like a stepping stone before she'll go into Alderdice. But to go from a small day school where they have small classes and individual attention, and then to go into Alderdice or to Reisenstein, I mean, that's really a major, major step. Right now, both daughters-in-law work full-time. I mean, this is part of today's life. They both use daycare for the summer. My one daughter-in-law now in Mount Lebanon, they were fortunate to find a young nanny, part of this nanny service. Otherwise, I mean, they have such a schedule that my son, Howard is an administrative law judge for the Liquor Control Board. That's his job now out in the Parkway Center. And Denise gets up at 5:30 to catch the subway. She works for the Human Relations Commission. And then my son dresses the two little girls. And then he takes them to a woman. This is today's lifestyle. And this woman takes one of them to the daycare center there at the temple. And then she keeps the younger one. The younger one was going 2 days a week, the older one 4 days a week. And then my son was taking off on Fridays. He arranged to have Fridays off because they had nobody to take care of their kids. That was also part of their arrangement. And he would take care of the two little girls on Friday. And he would come home earlier, pick them up during the week from this young woman that they paid, who was also a mother and had children at home. But she needed the extra money and was very good about it, so she took care of the two little girls in between. I can't even keep up with the schedule. We were babysitting there for a few days. We had to go out for a briefing, you know, as to how to fit into their lifestyle and even to work all the technical equipment in the house, because we're not used to that either. We don't have a VCR. We just got cable last year. So we don't even have a TV in the living room. So. Our older son, Julian, is very, he was involved for a while with the NABRIF, because Irv was very involved with the NABRIF. My husband, Irv, ended up being the district president of the NABRIF for the state of West Virginia, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. And he also served on the international board of the NABRIF. He also was a Sunday school teacher. Irv had the confirmation class at the Beth Shalom for 15 years. And he also taught at Rodef Shalom for about, say, a good 10 years, maybe longer. There was one time he had every eighth grader, he had the eighth grade kids at the Rodef Shalom on Saturday, because they had their classes on Saturday, and then he would teach on Sunday at the Beth Shalom. And I think we started this Sunday school teaching mainly because we were available and interested. And also we needed the little bit of car fare or money that you got in. It was a very small amount of money for the amount of time you put in to prepare the lesson plan and be at the teacher's meetings, etc. But it was still a far cry from when they used to pay teachers with a car check. When I spoke about years ago, earlier in the interview, they would give them their car fare, and they would also pay rabbis with a chicken, you know, for the Shabbos. So, what we made was a very small amount of money, but it certainly helped supplement our income, because we had absolutely nobody that gave us anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I said before, his mother was bedridden, they had to work, and my mother certainly had nothing. So when we even bought this house originally, we didn't know that you had to have closing costs. And we got down there and we were short $500. I mean, they had U.S. Stamps that you ended up buying at bonds years ago, U.S. savings bonds, and they would sell stamps every week in school, and whatever I had, $900 in that account at the Union Trust Building, whatever, wherever they held it, we used that money, whatever little bit of money we used, every last penny. And I had to call my uncle Irv, who ended up being a partner in the business, gave us the $500, and we paid him back, but it took us many years before we could even afford to pay him back. When we moved in this house, all we could afford was we put down our own linoleum in the kitchen. We put down, they would sell rolls of linoleum. It was $10.95. It looked like a carpet. We put that down here in the dining room. And in our first apartment, they had paper drapes right after the war. During the war, you couldn't get materials and fabrics, and we had printed, embossed paper drapes. They looked just like regular fabric, but they were very inexpensive, and they made the room look nice, and that's what we had. When we first moved in here, we also had a roomer, somebody that a family brought over from the survivor of the Holocaust. There was the Weiner family who ended up with this luggage business, big luggage business in Newcastle. They lived on the street. And through the Joint Distribution Committee, they saved a few young men and brought them over. And one of them ended up living here for about a year in our house. He worked in their luggage factory. And we didn't have carpeting on the steps. And I remember he got up very early. He walked down the hall, and the hardwood floors made noise in the steps. And religiously, the baby woke up every morning, but that too helped supplement, you know, the income. Also, you can't tell these stories to young people today. They wouldn't believe some of the stories. But I had an uncle that was a manager for Western Union. So on all the holidays, he needed extra delivery people to take the telegrams in crazy neighborhood streets that you never heard of, and you could make $35 or $40 that day in tips, you know. So my husband would go that day and help him out. He would, you know, we had a car, and he would make the extra money, and that was a lot of money for us, you know, extra money that we had to help support whatever our lifestyle was. I remember when we first got involved with the United Jewish Federation, and they came around to get our pledge. I had a little bank, and I had a broken open. I was embarrassed that I didn't have any other money, but that's what I took out, and I opened up that bank, and I gave them all the money. Mm-hmm. So that's how we started. We were very involved with the United Jewish Federation. It wasn't called that before, but when they had like weekend retreats in the young adult division, we and the small of us, our two close friends, were the first young married couples that went on this retreat. They didn't even have facilities at Laurel Y Camp to house married couples at the time, but we were very involved right from the beginning.
Tell us about the UJ then. Let's start with that.
Well, all right.
Was that before Pioneer Women?
All at the same time. We were always involved in all of these things at the same time. I mean, it turned out that ended up being my main avenue, but never the sole thing. To this day, never the sole thing. Mm-hmm. Because I always felt I didn't want to be in a tunnel. And with tunnel vision. And there were times that they wanted, the Rebbetzin came and the rabbi, they wanted me to take the sisterhood presidency. And then there were times they wanted us, both my husband and myself, to take a vice presidency in the synagogue. And as much as I consider, I always say I have three homes, this house, and the synagogue, and the State of Israel. Those are my three homes. But as much as I'm involved in the synagogue, the life there is still more of a tunnel, and they don't see the whole Jewish world and all the needs of the Jewish world. And even when you sit on the board there, most of the time they don't discuss the religious aspect of the synagogue or the moral aspect of the synagogue. They're discussing just basically the building and the roof, the doors, the salaries, the pensions, whatever it is. And if you want to discuss something that really has substance, the survival of Jewish people, wherever they live, they very often don't have time for it on their agenda. And I will say that, I mean, I think I was instrumental in moving them in many directions. When Israel Bonds first started, I was one of the first chairmen for Big Day. They called Bonds for Israel Government, when bonds were $50 each, and we went door to door knocking, trying to convince people to buy, to invest. You don't gift Israel bonds, you invest in Israel bonds. To convince people to invest in bonds. Now the sisterhood had a nice knipple because eventually they were going to add on to the building. They kept talking about it for years, and each president was waiting for costs, building costs to go down. They never went down. And it wasn't until Dr. Bill Stark really got a hold of things that they went on with the big building program. But the sisterhood had a knipple, I don't know, it was $8,000-$9,000, that my friend Irene Smoliver and I went to the meeting, and it took us several meetings till we convinced them to invest in Israel. I mean, they thought it was a terrible investment. They would never get their money back. You would think they were giving to the Vatican. That's how they felt. And they bought the first, they invested in the first $500 coupon bond. And every time that interest came on that coupon, these past presidents would look at us like we had stolen their money, you know. But it wasn't easy to convince people. We did the same thing. I'd go to the B'nai B'rith Lodge, you know, to convince the lodge and to convince the members to buy individual bonds. Mm-hmm. And then if they had a treasury, to take some of their money to invest it in Israel.
What percentage were they paying in those days?
I don't know, maybe 3.5%. All I can tell you is that I got so involved in the Israel Bond program that I ended up, they have these charms that they gave out every time you sold or bought, I think it was $1,500. I ended up getting all of them, and it wasn't because we had the money to buy the bonds. We started a bond club years ago, an Israel Bond Club. We still have it today, where you could invest every single month. We sent, to this very day, we send out the statements, we maintain an account, I have it in this drawer, we have all the books for, we had an Italian gardener that bought bonds that way, my mother used to buy her Israel bond that way, we still buy our bond that way, and my son and my machutin to this very day, not that he can't afford to buy the bond outright, but we have people that just for traditional reasons continue in this bond club, but the bond club was set up to encourage people to invest in Israel people that couldn't take out the $50, then it was $100, then it became $250. So they would pay it out at their own scheduled rates, $25 a month, send us a check, $50 a month, we deposit it. And then when all the money's paid up, we draw a check from the bank, I take it up to the, now the bond office is right over here, it's very convenient. I don't know if you know, they just moved to the corner of Wilkins and Beechwood from the Maxim Town. And we'd take the money up there. And as I say, to this day, we're involved, we're on the board of governors, whatever they call it, the Israel Bond Organization here in Pittsburgh. So that was one thing that we were, you know, always involved with. Years ago, I was always involved, and to this day, I have a push gift for JNF, for the Jewish National Fund. And I used to go with the kids when they were, we used to go to and literally open the boxes in houses. We had receipt books, and we had cards, and we would go door to door and open up the boxes and give them a receipt and then turn in the money, you know, and count the money. The same thing held true with the United Jewish Federation at the beginning. We would cover dollar cards and $2 cards, and we had, now they do it all in a Sunday telethon, but we had divisions, and, you know, we would divide the neighborhood, and, you know, I became a division chairman, and I had so many blocks and so many streets and so many cars that you covered, then you had people that worked under you. It was all set up like, you know, a corporate ladder, which right. It is to this very day, but they don't bother with the small cars. You just can't get the volunteers anymore. I mean, women are not available to go and open cans and to cover little cards and to go to, and people don't want to be bothered, won't even open the door for you. I will say that even with the Israel bonds, there were many doors that were slammed in our face mm-hmm. when we went out, you know, to try to encourage people mm-hmm. to invest in those years in Israel. We have not maintained the same involvement in the Federation, although I have served on the, I was on the Women's Division Board, I was on the Speaker's Bureau, I served two terms on the big board for Greater Pittsburgh, but once I became involved on the national level, I had several vice presidencies and I was forever traveling, so I wasn't that interested anymore, nor could I be that involved on the local community as I had been in the past. I mean, the same thing holds true with the synagogue and the sisterhood. My husband, he's an honorary board member. He served for so many years, and he goes to the board meetings. And our son, Julian, was just elected an officer at the Beth Shalom, and that's quite an honor for a young man. He wanted it, and he ran for that particular office because it is a very large congregation. He's maintained friendships with a young rabbi, with a present rabbi, and his wife is quite involved too, not real active, although she was in Pioneer Women when it was Pioneer Women. She was a president for three terms in her young chapter. But now, I don't think there's one woman in that chapter that doesn't hold a full-time position. So all the organizations have to take a different look at themselves, and I say we have to have clubs without walls, and we can't demand things, especially of women, where they hold full-time positions, full-time presidencies, year-round chairmanships. I mean, we have to take women when we can get them and use them for whatever period of time or whatever interest they happen to have to do a job. So they all happen to be life members. We have men that are life friends, and I'm not. They all are life friends or life members of NAMAT. My four granddaughters are also life affiliates. The other grandmother is a life member also and was a president of one of the groups. And I said to her, you make two of them life affiliates, and I'll make the other two so that we'll all be life affiliates. So they are all life affiliates of the organization. As far as going on to,
I think you have another 5 minutes. Still grinding.
Very interesting. So would you like to just conclude on this little part, and then when we start again, we'll start with NAMAT.
I was going back to the the involvement of the children and organizational life today. Going back even to my husband and his involvement too. Twice he was chairman of the Hillel board for the universities here,
mm-hmm.
and he serves on that board even to this day. At the moment, as I said when you came in, he's very involved in learning the Hebrew language, and I think his interest was piqued when we went to Israel to some of these international meetings, when they use simultaneous earphones and they translate into different languages, but you miss the conversation on the floor and the things that go on in the corridors because you don't have the translation. And he, since he didn't have the background, he couldn't read, or he could read, but he couldn't write Hebrew. Because he had gone to a Reformed temple, he decided that he was going to come back and start to study Hebrew. And this was while he was still working, and then once he retired, he really got into it. So he goes now 3 times a week to his Hebrew class. And I will say that he's very supportive of everything I do. There isn't a woman that, or anybody that can do anything without having support in the home and encouragement in the home. And I mentioned a while back that the minute I married him, I was liberated. More liberated than when I was in my family structure. And there were things that I thought I couldn't do or shouldn't do or didn't even want to do. And he was the one that encouraged me to go on and to do it. And maybe I'll end with this, because it'll be just a nice beginning, I think, for the next tape or the next time we meet. The thing that probably changed the course of my life the most was the fact that